Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lenny Mendoza, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors, a former senior partner at McKinsey & Company, and your moderator for the program today. It's my pleasure to introduce a man who needs no introduction, our special guest, Jeremy Affeldt. Jeremy, as you all know, was a former San Francisco Giants pitcher, but he is importantly a philanthropist and author of this fabulous book, To Stir a Movement, Life, Justice, and Major League Baseball. We'll be talking about that a lot during the course of today. Jeremy's baseball career spanned 14 years, included some preliminary, particularly uneventful stints with the Kansas City Royals, the Colorado Rockies, the Cincinnati Reds, and then really kicked it into gear as 7 years with the San Francisco Giants. He retired as a player on October 4th, 2015, and has become, as of this year, a Giants community ambassador, and we'll talk about that as well. As you all know, Jeremy played on all three San Francisco Giants World Championship teams, 2010, 2012, 2014. And during that time, he really was amazing. For his career, he has a record of 2-0, 0.86 ERA in 33 postseason games, the third lowest in history among pitchers with at least 30 innings.
Yeah. Not bad.
He also had 22 straight scoreless postseason appearances since allowing one run in Game 1 of the 2010 World Series. Quite a run. Well done.
Yeah, thank you.
But importantly, Jeremy is one of the people who proves that there is, in fact, life after baseball. He's an active leader to end human trafficking and modern-day slavery. He's an advocate to support and feed the hungry at home and around the globe. He's the co-founder of Generation Alive, a nonprofit organization that works to teach and inspire a generation of young people to act by serving others. In addition to being an author of the book I mentioned, he's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and Medium.com, where he has a regular blog that I encourage you all to subscribe to. Jeremy and his wonderful wife, Larissa, live in Spokane with their three boys. And it's my pleasure, again, and I ask you all to give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Jeremy Affeldt.
Thank you.
All right, so, Jeremy, we're going to spend a fair amount of time talking about your life after baseball, but I'm sure that no one in the audience wants to talk at all about baseball, so we may start with a couple of those questions. So let me start with, at least as of this morning, the Giants are a half game ahead of the Dodgers and having a little bit of challenge maintaining leads in the late innings. So on behalf of all of the members of this audience, what's it going to take to get you to come back and join the team this year?
Yeah. Yeah. That's flattering. Thank you for that. It'd probably take 6 months of throwing and a couple more weeks of the minor leagues. But you're right. They're struggling a little bit. And I've actually pondered it. A couple weeks ago I was watching and I was like, man, maybe I'll come back. And I was like, I just need to maybe help these guys with their identity a little bit in the bullpen. And then I was thinking about it, and I asked someone, I said, maybe I should come back. And they're like, yeah, you should do it. And I'm like, I did a speech, man. You can't do a retirement speech. Cry on a baseball field and say, yeah, just kidding, I'm going to come back now. This is not going to work, So, and I don't think Bochy, man, he's been in the hospital. I don't think his heart can handle, man, me coming back. Throwing scuds out there, and he's panicking enough as is, but they'll be fine. I'm looking forward to seeing them come into their own. I always remind people, August 2014, everybody, you see all the stuff on Twitter, and bullpen stinks, and all that stuff, and we need a new bullpen. You should come out of retirement. And I just want to remind people, in August of 2014, I did so bad. Most people were asking me to retire, not come back. And we were struggling, man. We lost like 17 of 19, And so to see them in this rut now, I'm actually not that worried. I think fans panic a little more than players do. But I kind of don't mind it right now, I would say in the next couple of weeks, if we're still doing this, I would probably say we need to have a sense of urgency. But right now, I'm looking forward to this bullpen kind of clicking. We have a couple of new additions. Obviously, you know, Buster's been out kind of with the back stuff. But with getting guys back and healthy, I really feel like then they're set up to run. Because reality is, I am a Giants fan. I am a Giants fan. I am pro black and orange. I am against the baby blue. But the but we are better than the Dodgers. And I'm not saying that just because I'm a Giants fan. I really am not. I'm not just saying we're better than the Dodgers. I'm saying that I look at our team and their team, and we're not even playing up to our potential by any means. And so I'm looking for us to kind of click in a little bit there and run with this thing, because we should be 13 games up. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So, without me, you know.
So in those prior runs, it wasn't an even year. I mean, you guys got it together in the last month or so.
That's right.
And it wasn't a cakewalk in any of those. So, you know, you're now an observer of the team as opposed to being on it. But seriously, what's it going to take for them to get their act together to do it again? What's the key to the team here?
It's understanding. You got to eventually come to the what we had to do when we were struggling a little bit is we basically said, okay, enough's enough. Like, we have to sit there and believe that every time we cross those lines that we are the best. And I don't care how we got to get it done. I don't care what pitches you got to make. I don't care if you have to make up a pitch. I don't care if you have to. You got to say, I'm going to get this guy out. I'm going to do some damage today on this field. I'm going to make plays that are unbelievable. I'm going to lay out. I'm going to dive. I'm going to turn double plays that shouldn't be turned. I'm going to get to balls that shouldn't be gotten to. You have to have that mentality when you go out there. And you get into this lull a little bit as an athlete where you kind of see these dog days of summer, they call it. And you just kind of forget to do that. But eventually, someone's going to snap in the clubhouse, right, and get tired of this happening, and it'll wake people up. And then the next thing you know, you've got, you know, Hunter hitting homers every other bat, Buster's hitting key doubles and homers, guys taking extra bases. We're scoring when we should be scoring and staying when we should be staying on base, you know, instead of running around and getting thrown out of home. But that is understandable. But then all of a sudden the starters are going to kick in, and there's going to be – I'm telling you, I'm sure you guys are going to call me biased because he's one of my best friends, but I'm telling you watch Kane, man. He's going to step up, and he's going to figure out a way to get 6-7 innings out of himself, and he's so competitive, and he so wants to do it. That guy's going to step in, and when that guy steps in with Bum and Cueto, it's going to elevate the other two guys, and you're going to see a rotation that starts throwing up zeros, and they're going to be dominant. I really feel it's just going to take a little bit of that. You know what? Enough's enough. We need to go ahead and finish this division.
It's interesting that you describe that more as a personal leadership question than something about, you know, we need bullpen, or it's more of a team kind of let's
right. We're mentality. Yep.
Convinced. Well, you know, it is an even year, and we know what happens in even years in San Francisco. And I don't mean the Olympics or an election. There's something that happens at AT&T Park. But, you know, for those of us who are Giants fans and have been following this, we all think that's normal course. But I may have this wrong, but I was looking back, and of the team that won the championship in 2010, the only people who are still around, the only hitter is Posey, the only starting pitcher is Kane. And after you left, it's only Lopez and Romo who are still in the bullpen. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the coaching staff, for the most part, is the same manager, same general. But is there something about the Giants that allows them to do this in a way that's not just luck? I mean, how do you keep this going?
I think it's character. You know, one of the things that I learned about the Giants before they signed me is they had Flannery. Funny that had Flannery too. I love Flannery. It's just funny they had him do it. He's usually not awake that early in the morning to be able to do it. But they ended up giving him my name, and they had him call all the coaches that I played for that he knew, and research who I was on the field, off the field, in the clubhouse. How did other people view me? Coaches? How did players view me? They called a couple key players that I had played with, and they said, how do you view them in the clubhouse? They do so much research on guys before they sign free agents. They build teams with character, and they build teams with the understanding of they cannot be just good on the field, because if there's a bad seat in the clubhouse, it'll affect what you do on the field. And that's why you see a lot of the Giants when you're seeing them. They're pretty lovable guys, man. It's not, they're good in the community. They like hanging out. They're funny. we're misfits. You know, we've got that deal. Like we're kind of a weird group of guys, but we all connect really, really well on and off the field. And when you see that, and when I feel like I can take the field, and I'm not just taking the field for my own personal statistics or my contract, I'm taking the field because I have a love for 25 guys that I want to win for, and all 25 guys feel that same way, it's going to be awesome, and you're going to win. And that's when you see that camaraderie, that will a team with good camaraderie will outdo a good team that's better than you. Detroit was better than us, frankly. Texas was better than us. Who did we beat in the last World Series? you know, Kansas City. Yeah. Sorry. Every time Kansas City, I try to forget about them because my early years, I just try to forget they're even a baseball team. But Kansas City was pretty even with us there. That's why you went seven games. But honestly, the Texas Rangers and Detroit Tigers, they were better than us. And the reason we beat them is because we gelled so much as a team that we figured out what each other's strengths and weaknesses were, and we kind of molded and said, okay, you're weak in this area, but you're strong in that area, so we're going to use you for this and you for that. And everybody knew their role. And when you know your role in the lineup, when you know your role as a pitcher, when you know your role as a bullpen guy, when you know your role leadership-wise, you're going to have guys that – you're going to have Buster, who leads by example, doesn't show a lot of emotion until the World Series is won, and that's when you see the Buster hugs, right? But And then you've got, you know, I'm kind of the guy that I'll call you out when you need to be called out. I'll do it respectfully, but I'm a little bit more vocal. And then you got Hunter, who's throwing seeds all over the place and got the eyes and crazy, you know, stuff, you know. And so you have that kind of leader, the rah-rah guy, right? You know, I'm not a big rah-rah guy, but you have to have that for some guys. And when you have that stuff built in, you will beat teams that are better than you simply because you're just a better team overall. Not talent, not statistically maybe, but overall, there is that will to win. There's that camaraderie, that band of brothers mentality that says I'm gonna fight to the guy left of me, and I'm gonna make sure he's protected at all times. And we do really well at that on this team. And I think that's what I still see with this team, and that's why I don't panic too much right now in the situation they're in.
So you do some pre and post game work with Flannery now. Have you ever asked him how he screwed up on the due diligence that got you to join the Giants?
Man. I tell you, he was like, after I saw some of your early plays and your scenarios on the field and your antics, everybody was looking down at me, and I'm like, well, who lied to me before we brought you in here? You know, he's like, they said you're athletic, you're running a ball over and you're dropping it in the first baseman, you're not throwing it, can hardly get the ball to the plate half the time, you know, like you're falling down, you're blowing out your knees, you're stabbing yourself. He's like, who is this guy? You know, so I brought some humor on and off the field, I think, a little bit. Yeah.
So seriously, though, they do take a look at a player's character in addition to their athletic ability. Yeah. What does that mean? And what are you looking for when you're saying this is a group of people that gel with character? What is it? It's not just you're not a jerk. There's something more that you're looking
for.
Yeah,
it's not. There's that you don't, because there are still jerks in the game that can still gel well with a team, right? And I think what they see is, okay, these are the openings that we have, and this is the kind of team we've built. So will this guy fit in with that team? And if it's going to be a big self-promoting guy, they don't necessarily want that. You know, they're not really into that kind of stuff, really. You're seeing guys. Now, there's guys. Obviously, social media is really big, even for the player. We understand there is some marketing there. But if it's a dig-me, rah-rah guy where all eyes on me, those guys kind of can be cancerous throughout a clubhouse, and it can kind of cause a lot of people not to win, right? And so when it becomes a guy that's like, hey, I'm for the team, because Bochy runs an interesting gig, man. Your three-hole hitter isn't always your three-hole hitter. Your six-hole hitter, sometimes your three, sometimes it's six-hole. So he's got to be able to have guys that are willing to, I'm going to adjust a little bit the lineups here, and if I got a guy complaining and whining all the time because he's not hitting three-hole or four-hole or six-hole, I don't really want him. And that's the kind of guys they stay away from. We need a guy that, hey, if I Boach is a very strategic thinker in how he wins games. So if he can be, if he's willing to adjust, then I'm okay with it and still play with a lot of confidence and boldness of who he is. Not exactly, I'm not going to be a good hitter unless I'm hitting three in the lineup. And you'll see that with our bullpen. In 2010, 12, and 14 especially, it wasn't, I mean, you had Wilson as a closer, but then in 12 you had Romo. 14 Casilla. You know, you had bum closing out games in game seven. You know, like, you run the gauntlet, and you got to have guys that are willing to be mentally and emotionally ready to do that and serve their team at all costs and be what they need to be, whatever the team needs them to be at the time. And there's only certain guys that are like that, and they're servants, and they're servant leaders, and they're guys that are saying, look, I know that this is who I am, but if you need me to be this now, I'm willing to do it. And there's not a lot of guys that are like that, and we have 25 of them. And I think that's very, very important. It's a credit to the leadership of Sabian and Evans. It's a credit to some of the coaching staff, Bochy, and it's also a credit to the guys that are coming in that clubhouse and understand when you put on a Giants uniform, you're expected to win. And that's what the Yankees were in the 90s. That's what Boston was in the early 2000s. And now that's what the Giants are. Before, when you put on a Giants uniform the last 20 years, you win, maybe. You know, there's a cool history behind it. But now you put on a Giants uniform, whether you're traded or signed as a free agent, you're just going to do better because of who you represent, the city you represent. And that's kind of the aura that we have right now on that team.
That's great. Well, you have transitioned into a different role with the Giants now. You said you didn't retire, although I was at the game where it was your non-retirement speech. And there was not a dry eye from anybody around, including you and including me.
Yeah.
But you've transitioned to a different role. Tell me what you're doing with the Giants now, and tell me a little bit about what that's like to be on the other side of the field now.
Yeah, so when I was asked, you know, before I retired, Larry sat with me and he said, he knew I was going to retire, and he said, I still want you with us, and somehow, and in some way, shape, or form. And I said, well, I would like to be able to help out in the community, because of one of the things that I really enjoyed about being a Giants player is how community-oriented the team was. And they're very much a part of this community, and I think that's what the Giants fans feel, is the Giants aren't just like in the stadium, or, you know, the players aren't just in the stadium, and the Giants just aren't a stadium within the city limits. They're actually part of the community. I think that was key to why they built the stadium where they built it. They wanted to be a part of the community of San Francisco and be a part of this area more. And Larry Bear is obviously very, very big, you know, in the nonprofit world and trying to give back. And I resonated with that. I've been on four teams, and I can tell you, man, Kansas City, as a young player, because I was typically a guy that they were still wanting to push in the community, I was a part of a lot of community events. Cincinnati and Colorado, I really didn't do anything. I asked Cincinnati and they didn't put me in because I was a rental player. And they're like, you're here for a year. We're not going to waste a lot of time on you. And so when I got here, I was just very enthusiastic about being a part of the community. But what I took a lot of joy in is seeing how much the team wanted me a part of the community and found ways. They said, what are you into? Where can we help out? The way they've taken on a group that I've become an ambassador with, Not For Sale, and said, well, we'll do a Not For Sale night. I mean, they brought in the organizations that I was a part of and said, we'll create a night for those organizations. And to me, for a team to do that and to take maybe their agenda and shift it to our agenda when it came to the players, that's very important to me. And community is very important to me, and understanding the aspects of a community that even in a wealthy community like San Francisco, there is a tremendous amount of poverty, because there's always, the poor will always be among you, and it's always here. And I want people to understand that just because I play baseball and we make millions of dollars and we play in these cathedrals and we fly on private planes to all these different cities, I put my pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else. And I want people to understand that. And I want people to understand that I see the pain that poverty has and creates within a community and the people that are a part of it. And if we can use our platform to help alleviate those pains, that's what I want to do. And so that's very much why I wanted to come back as a Giant, to still be a part of this community and still be able to push the Giants in those communities. Visit. I didn't want to be a community ambassador maybe and just be with the players. I mean, I do stuff with them in spring training. I did not want to be the coach in uniform that kind of just hung out with the players. I could have done that. I thought it was a little too early for me to do it, because I feel like if I was in uniform, the players would still make fun of me like I'm a player rather than respect me as a coach. So I knew that was a little bit interesting, so I didn't want to do that. But I wanted to come back. I want to come into the community. I want to promote the team, you know, as a team, but also want to promote them as who they are. And that's a fixture in this community that gives back and is willing to help out in areas of need. And so I get to be a part of that. I'm excited.
That's fantastic. Now, we see you day to day on the pre and post game shows for a lot, including you're going to do it this evening, right?
I am, yeah.
But not everyone knows what you do in the community and what you did in your book, which I would encourage everyone to read. It's in addition to being very interesting, it's actually Jeremy's voice. A lot of people have these books. Someone else writes it for them. Mm-hmm. You wrote this book.
Yeah, I did. I didn't physically type. I don't have a lot of time. I have three boys that would be swinging from these chandeliers right now if they were here. So they got a lot of energy. So I don't have the time to do that. But what I did have is a voice. And my friend came in and I said, I don't have a lot of time to type. And I don't really spell all that great. So I'm going to need help with that. And he said, well, we'll take care of that. So he came in with a recorder and he gave me 81 topics. And in 3 days, I recorded 16 hours of my views on 81 different topics. And my wife was actually really excited because I was locked in a room and she didn't have to hear me talk about it. She was like, as long as you're down there, you know, I don't have to hear you talk for 16 straight hours. I'm fine with it. So she was okay with it. But then they transcribed it and they sent it to me. And this book took a little longer for me to write because, you know, the transcriber would write it, put it into a chapter form. I would edit it. I would add a story. I maybe got a statistic wrong. I made my maybe embellished a little bit on the recording, and so I need to make myself, you know, look a little worse than I probably made it sound on the recording because you can check my facts, right? So I wasn't as good as I said I was, you know, and so I'd have to fix those things. But it was a fun book to write because it was who I was as a baseball player, why I hated the game, why I did what I did when I gave money back. You know, and I didn't announce that I gave money back, and the only reason it came out is because it was in my book, and one of the writers, Henry Shulman, read it and was intrigued by it, because I didn't want to be known for that. I did it for a reason. Everything with how this city completely changed me to a point where I was homophobic, and I didn't want to be around this city when I played here. To now, I cherish the community that San Francisco has, and all of the scenarios that San Francisco embodies, and getting into situations where I just learned to truly and genuinely love my neighbor as myself, and to know that I don't live for myself, but I look at people as human beings. We might have differences of opinion. We might have political views that are different. We might have moral views that are different. We might have all kinds of these views, but you're a human being, and I truly love the human being. And this city changed that about me, and it got me to get out of my black and white mold and understand that there are people that have hearts and minds, and there's wounds that people have, and I don't want to be aiding in those wounds or in any way, shape, or form. And so this city really changed that. And so learning about baseball and my journey of baseball and understanding that I wanted to quit, to thriving in the game, to understanding that every moment and every failure that I had in the game allowed me to go to different teams that eventually got me to San Francisco, into a city that changed my life. And so that's what I wrote about, and that's why I'm a part of the I'm thoroughly a part of injustices in the world, because I think that's part of our human mandate to be a part of. When you see an injustice, to try to create justice in those areas. The city was huge for me in that area, human trafficking, to poverty, to understanding what it's like to deal with people of different cultures and generations. Everything happened a lot here, but there was a story that got me here, and that's what I tell in that book.
That's great, and I want to come back to that a little bit in terms of what you're doing with that, but now that I understand more completely how you wrote that book, now I know why Larissa is telling you need to write another book.
Yeah, so yeah. Lock me in a room and keep me out of there. Go talk to that guy. I'm tired of talking.
Before we come to a little bit about how you think about making a difference in purpose and impact, I you did mention that you are also seriously considering in the process of another book.
It's called No Man. So I have a tattoo on my left forearm. It says, "No man shall live for himself." And it's my version of Love Your Neighbor as Yourself. I just think "No man shall live for himself" sounds cooler. So so I went with that one. But and it's called No Man. And what it is, it's going to be about servant leadership. And it's going to be a little bit deeper into my journey of to stir a movement is that. It's to stir the movement of servant leadership in communities and in businesses and where you're at and how to be a servant leader and to take on certain areas of your community using a platform, whatever platform you've given, to make change and to create cultural change. I just feel like the no man is a little bit deeper into what it means to me to be a servant leader. And so it's going to go deeper into my views of what that means. And what does it mean to be a leader in your family? What does it mean to be a leader in your community, in your workplace? What servant leadership means, and the impact that it creates on that. So I'm really excited for this book to come out. It's taken me a long time. The person helping me with that book knows it's taking me a long time, especially to get back to her. So she's kind of getting itchy a little bit, but I'm excited for the book. I thought I'd only write one, and then I said I'd only write two, and now I've got a third one in mind on leadership. But I'm looking forward to No Man. I think it'll be a fun book for my sons to read. The keys to writing books for me are not just to write books. The keys for me are leaving a legacy. And I've got three boys, and I've told every one of them, I know you're 9, 6, and 4, but you're all leaders. And if I were to die and get hit by a bus tomorrow, and you want to know what your dad stood for, I want you to know that these books are exactly what I stand for. And so if you want to know who I am, if I don't live long enough for you to experience it, I want to make sure that you know it and can read about it. And so these are why these books are being written.
That's great. And we're going to have you back and talk about those when they're out next year. So let's talk a little bit about your own sense of what you're speaking about and your view of life's lessons. You wrote about it in the book. It's a lot of what you talk about when you're with different audiences today. You know, we know you, and the public knows you as an amazing athlete, but that's not how you view yourself. That was an important part. But you have a broader purpose in how you view the world. How did that come about, and how do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, in 2000, some of you might have heard this story, some of you may have not. In 2006, I got traded to Colorado, and I hated baseball. I mean, I went from a 12-year-old boy loving the game of baseball to a 22-year-old young man that was just super excited to achieve the big league career and to achieve the goal that I had since I was a kid, to within 4 years hating the game and hating Major League Baseball and wanting no part of it anymore. And knowing that I played in Kansas City and pretty much you got booed every time. But even the concept of being booed or cheered, to me, it was Groundhog's Day. If you did well, you got cheered. If you did bad, you got booed. I get it. Like, and for me, I was like, this is boring. Why am I a major league athlete? Because if that's what it's for, to come to the field every day and be cheered or booed and to say that I struck a guy out and know that my whole identity was on the premise of I won and lost that day or I got this guy out or I did my job or didn't do my job on a baseball field, I don't see the point of being a baseball player. And so I didn't want to play. I literally remember getting so desperate. I was like, I started praying. I was like, God, please just get me out of Kansas City. I mean, what it released me, I was hoping I'd get released because then as an athlete, you didn't quit. The team quit on you. So you're like, sweet, got released, tried my best, and now I go home. And so I was kind of hoping for that. And then I remember at the trade deadline, my GM calling me and say I got traded to Colorado. My wife was super excited. And I kind of was excited until I got on the plane and I realized there was no gravity in Colorado. And I was remember looking up and I was like, maybe I should have been a little more specific on the trade scenario. Somewhere where I would succeed, not where things don't come down and homers happen, right? And it's 18-17, you know, it's like a football score, you know, there. And I remember getting there and just feeling so alone because I couldn't tell anybody that I hated Major League Baseball, right? And it didn't make sense in my mind that I hated being a Major League athlete. And so, like, you were so alone in your mind, you were confused, you didn't know what you were even on planet Earth for, because I didn't think that was a really cool goal at the time, to be a Major League athlete. If that's all I'm here for, I don't really understand it. To walking out of my hotel in Colorado and meeting a young girl in Starbucks, just outside of it. She was sitting at a Rite Aid and she was 16 years old, you know, broken lip, black eye, ripped clothes, a lot of street kids. If you've ever been to Denver, you'll see a lot of homeless teenagers. That's kind of where they go. And she just had a rough night. And I remember reaching down, touching her on the shoulder and she shied away from me. And she said, yeah, I said, I don't want anything from you. I just want to know if you want something to eat. And she said, yes, please. And so I went to Starbucks and they didn't have Pete's, you know, so I went to Starbucks, you know. I got to get that in there, you know. I went to Starbucks and they got this green sludgy thing, naked drink or whatever. It looks bad, tastes good, right, for you. It's all that good vegetables and stuff. And then I got her something with the most sugar possible. And some muffin, some blueberry muffin. And I walked out and I handed it to her and she ripped it from my hands and she looked at me and she said, thank you. And at that moment, my whole entire view on baseball life changed because it wasn't just a thank you. It was, man, our eyes met and it was like for a few moments, our souls connected to a point. It was like, this girl was lost, confused, no idea who to talk to, scared. I was lost, confused, no idea who to talk to, and scared. I dressed better. I had a better job. I had a house to live in. She had no home. She ripped clothes, and she had no job, obviously. So her life, from what people see, were different than mine, but our emotional state of mind were the same. And when she said thank you, it was not just a thank you. It was thank you for telling me that I exist, because everybody walks on the other side of the street when they see me. Or they walk by me and they keep their eyes up and they don't want to look down. We all do it. We all have done it. We all will do it because we don't want to deal with it. And there is a sense of letting people know they exist that will change everybody's mentality on life. And when she let me know that that's what it meant, not just a good deed, but an actual, like, you let me know that I existed and you provided a need that I had that I was not getting. That meant a lot to that girl. My biggest mistake that day was not letting her know or not asking her story, right? I didn't understand how she got to where she got because it would have been an interesting one for me to share mine. But I went to the field that day and I sat there in the bullpen and was thinking, why do I have so much joy? And I figured, and it was because I used a scenario. I was in a city at a certain time in such a moment as this to be able to say, like, I was actually there at that time in that moment to provide something for that individual that hopefully saved her life. Because it was a random act of kindness. I just love my neighbor as myself. I just looked at her and I said, I when I'm hungry, I got to get something to eat. So you don't have that ability. I want to provide that for you. And to be able to have that platform, to be able to do that on a major scale with the media outlets that I have, the impact that I have with a microphone on my head, and to be able to have, you know, the financial means to be able to create maybe scenarios for those people, I said from that moment on, if I'm going to continue to play this game, I play for other people. I play for my children, my future children. We were not pregnant at the time. We're about to be. I did not know that. and people in the community and getting to understand that as athletes, I'm tired of being sold out to the media as this negative deal where we shoot ourselves in the foot in nightclubs or we're raping women or we're driving and we're getting DUIs. I'm tired of that. I want to be known as so much more than that, and I don't want that stereotype. But the only way to get to change that stereotype is to provide opportunities and to become a different stereotype. And I want to become a servant leader, and I want people to know athletes can do that. And so that was my life goal as an athlete, and I got to come to San Francisco, and that's when I started learning about human trafficking, and that's what I do now. I'm using my platform as a post player to still create impact in communities the best way that I know how, and to use my skill set and what I did as a player and what I'm doing after a player to create cultural change in communities that I'm a part of.
That's terrific. And I want to use this quick moment to remind our listeners on the radio that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. And our guest today is former San Francisco Giant pitcher and transitioning impact player, Jeremy Affeldt, who is discussing his life on and his life after the field. You can also find video of the Commonwealth Club's program online on the club's YouTube channel. So, Jeremy, I want to talk a little bit now about what you're doing outside of baseball and how you're using that platform to make a difference in the world. And a number of the questions, and I know they've gotten a number of questions, a lot of them were asking about this. So talk a little bit about a platform that you've created that's very near and dear to you, Generation Alive, and what that is and what you're doing there.
Yeah, I created that platform actually when I was in Kansas City because I was searching for meaning and understanding what I can do. And so when I created Generation Alive, it was initially a leadership concept of, well, I don't know what else to do, so maybe I can go into high schools and talk about making smart choices, because the athletes make dumb choices. We do. And when we make dumb choices, it's exposed at a higher level than a lot of people when they make bad choices, right? So, you know, and I said, you know what, I want to create a role model scenario. And how can, as a role model, how can I train or talk to kids about surrounding themselves with people that believe in them, making good decisions, having goals for your life. And that was all awesome until a girl came up to me in high school and she's like, hey, man, that was a cool presentation. I was like, thank you. She's like, but I don't know if it's going to work. And I looked at her and I was like, all right, talk to me. She's like, well, you say to surround yourself with people that believe in us and make good decisions. Well, what if we're environments where our whole survival tactic is to steal and to cheat and to lie? Because to stay alive in some of these communities of poverty, you can't be necessarily the good person because you'll die. She's like, I'm in situations where the only people I know around me are the ones that are part of gangs. And the only people that I know that are actually protecting me and keeping me alive are the people that are literally stealing, cheating, lying, doing drugs, selling drugs to create environments to protect us and keep us safe. And when we protect each other, it's through violence. She goes, what about people like that? That we have no choice because it's where we live. And I'm like, I didn't think of that, you know? And I'm in my little, nice home and like, looking at these kids, like make better decisions, like you're not going to be dealing drugs, make a better decision. She's like, but that's not our environment. And that's when I started, something changed. And I was like, well, this has got to change then, because I wasn't getting any momentum with the story. I mean, it was fun and schools were allowing me in because I was free. They didn't want me in until I told them I wasn't going to charge them. And then they're like, well, come on in, So, that's the only way I could get in. And I was like, but there's no impact. And so I started looking at the poverty scenario. And when I met this girl and someone said, man, you should really look into what it means to impact a community when you actually take people even of that have wealth and get them to understand what it means to serve people that do not have wealth and see what actually communities of people that don't have wealth can raise funds for each other to create opportunities for them in their own environment. Man, so we got into that. And I started Generation Alive, and it became an organization that goes in, we're either in elementary all the way through college, and we give presentations on what it means to be a servant leader and understand what compassion is and how what compassion does. And we don't want just this sense of oh, I feel bad for you. A person of compassion feels bad and then does something about it. And that's what compassion is. And so what I have wanted to do is like, what are the pains that poverty causes in a community, and what kind of organization or programs through ideas of compassion can we do to alleviate the pains of poverty in your community? And how can we can start at a young age so these kids are learning about this and growing up and becoming somebody great to do this and give back. And that's what this organization became. And we've adopted, I started learning a lot of this through the well issues and water crisis around the world. And what we found out right now, it's easier for us with young people when it comes to hunger and when it comes to human trafficking, they engage. They engage in hunger because our program is very simple. It costs 25 cents to feed somebody. So they raise 20, they can raise, my son does lemonade stands and in an hour can feed 20 people and loves it because he's a 9-year-old boy that just made an impact in 9 people's lives that he said, I actually did this. I mean, it empowers them. And the empowerment of young people is very, very important. I think you will see cities, countries, nations, and world change when you see that the younger generation says, I can make a difference. And I'm going to make a difference. And when we can empower the youth of our culture, that's when change happens. And that's what we're doing. And then they're gravitating to the trafficking because the average age of a sexual trafficked victim is 12 in this country. In this country, it's 12. So when you're seeing that a 12-year-old girl hears that, and she's like, "My own peers," you're like, "Yeah." Well, so how can I help? Well, we have to be obviously sensitive to how we promote the trafficking in different areas of schools because, we can't do some stuff in elementary schools because of the sensitivity of the issue. But these people, these young adults and young leaders are saying, well, can we do backpacks? Can we create something when these girls are rescued to help give them something that they don't have? And so you're seeing this flood of youth culture pouring in to this deal. I watched a college, Whitworth, in Spokane, package 650,000 meals in 2 days. And it almost impacted Spokane tremendously. I mean, the food banks were filled with food and because of one university. I watched Gonzaga, another university that I'm a part of in Spokane, go Zags. I know your St. Mary's fans are offended, but it is what it is. packaged back, put together backpacks, watching these young kids go into the communities and go into hotels and ask for their spare shampoos, go into these stores and ask for these feminine products that can they donate. And I'm watching a community get involved in this is amazing to me. And whether they're surrounding the kids with helping them with funding the hunger initiatives, or they're getting involved with the young adults of the college community, of these businesses come in and help with the trafficking, that to me is community. That's people coming together and saying, we'll be able to do whatever we can do with our platforms, whether a businessman, a lawyer, a student, a younger student, a college student, and say, how can we create change in our community? That's what I'm all about. And as an athlete, I've been given platforms to be able to speak onto those things and to push that stuff in my community. And that's what Generational Live does. And we're down here in San Francisco. We do a lot of stuff in the Bay Area. I mean, it is awesome. And the staff I have are tremendous. And I get to just kind of, you know, I'm on the board. I don't do everyday stuff. I'm pretty busy. So I can't do the everyday, but I do the fundraising. I'm on the board. I go and do the hunger initiatives when they're doing it in program. And I get to be a part of some amazing things and see what a community does just because an athlete decided to say, I'm going to put my pants on one leg at a time here. And I'm going to be a part of a community, and I'm not just going to alienate myself, and I'm going to make a change. And I'm really excited I got to do it and get to do it.
That's fabulous. You've also spent a lot of time, and I've spent time with you. When you came to San Francisco, you got more actively involved in the issue of human trafficking here with the organization called Not For Sale. You want to talk a little bit about how that came about and what they do and how you're engaged there?
Yeah, so when I started learning about poverty and all these issues, and I kept hearing about slavery, and I'm like, what? And this is in 2008, so I was like, I thought slavery died with the Civil War. You know, I was pretty, you know, oblivious to the situation, obviously. And now I found out there's more slaves now than when it was legal to have slaves. So you could see how it's transitioned to, it's all about money. It's a $32 billion business. There's 37 million slaves. You can take advantage of people in poverty, and you can make a lot of money off them and treat human beings as a reusable product, which I think is one of the most unjust things you can do to a human being. And so when I started learning about human trafficking, I found out that I listened to a guy named Dave Batstone. Someone sent me a thing he did in England, and I started researching the guy, and I just signed with San Francisco, and now the next thing I know, this guy lives in San Francisco, started an organization in San Francisco called Not For Sale, and I was just completely like baffled by it, because I'm like, wait, I just signed here. And I signed in a city that I said I'd never sign in. And if you any kind of have any kind of biblical background, it's like Jonah's whale, right? Like I got shot out of some fish to a city that I didn't want to go to, and and now all of a sudden it's like I'm reading about an organization that I'm very intrigued about, and he's here, and it's awesome, right? And so I got to meet him, and he told me a lot about Not For Sale and what they're doing with business, how they're creating opportunities for people to be able to not be a part of trafficking situations because of businesses that are being made to help these situations. And I got to be a part of the orphanage that we built up in Thailand, and I got to go visit these kids that were taken out of trafficking at 5 and 6 years old, and these little girls that were just put in such adult situations. And I got to put a basketball court in because a bunch of baseball players that I got involved in this said, we'll donate some money for every strikeout or every double. I'll donate money based on whether you're a pitcher or a hitter. And then sometimes like Matt Holliday was involved. He was given way more money, so I give up a double to him just because he gave up more money than if I struck him out, you know? So it was like, great, you know, I'm going to fundraise here. Just don't score, you know? Like, that's kind of how it worked. And we had a deal, him and I, with that, you know? So it just depended on the situation. I made no deals with Dodgers, so you don't have to worry about that. But the so it was a great time, and we built a basketball court. What we did it for is because an outdoor basketball court provides foursquare, volleyball, basketball, a lot of different things that these kids got to do. So when we pulled them out of adult situations that they shouldn't be in, we taught them how to be kids again and just play, right? Just play, you know, just have fun. And that's kind of what I got to be a part of here in this city and get engaged in. And now I got more athletes. I think we have over 50 athletes engaged. Last year we did a free to play where they said today we don't take salary, And there's 50 players that decided on a certain day not to take their daily salary and donate it to Not For Sale for to help these kids be rescued from trafficking. And what an awesome opportunity we've been able to be a part of, to expose the situation that's so devastating to human beings. And I've gotten to be a part of a lot of different discussions. I've got to meet a lot of important people because of it and talk to them about what's going on. And don't be oblivious to it. Don't be afraid of it. Don't say, wow, that's a huge number, so I don't even want to know about it. The only way to rescue some of these kids, and if you can take one human being out of that scenario, it's important. And the reason it was important to me is because when I was in the Oakland Coliseum, I was 10 years old, maybe 11. I was watching these guys play in Oakland. I used to live in Merced, and my dad would take me to Giants and Oakland A's games. And I remember sitting in these really cool seats. My dad usually got me the nosebleed section seats. So we had to, in Oakland, it's like legitimately nosebleed sections, right? Like anytime a ball was hit, you thought it was a homer. It was a pop-up to short just because you didn't know, I remember and he got me really good seats, and I was seeing these awesome players play, and I was like, Dad, I want to play here one day. And he patted me on the head, and he, go for it, kid, and I remember at 22 years of age, I walked into that Coliseum, and I got on my cell phone, and it was the Nokia one where you played the worm game. It was like your best game at that time. We didn't have, the other phones, smartphones, and I got on my, and I called my dad, and I said, Dad, I said, you know where I'm at? He said, yeah, you're in Oakland. And I said, Dad, you know what this means. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, Dad, I see the seats that you and I were sitting in when I said one day I'm going to play here and tonight I pitch. And my dad hung up the phone. And I was like, maybe bad cell coverage, Yeah. So I called back and my mom answered and I said, what happened? She said, well, your dad's crying. So he hung up. And it was just that moment of like getting to achieve something that I dreamed of, my dad knowing, and knowing that I had that ability to say one day I'm going to be. And trafficking kills that ability for people to say one day I'm going to be, because it's other people saying, no, this is what you are and this is all you're going to be good for. And that's not okay. And I fight for that voice. I fight for that ability for people to have that voice to say one day I'm going to be, because we all deserve that right. And trafficking doesn't allow that. And so for whether you're in the labor trade or you're in the sex trade, it's all inhumane. And I'll do my best to do whatever I can to help alleviate that situation.
Okay. You've also been passing on your perspective on how to make a difference in the world, the lessons that you've learned to audiences that are very different, whether it's a business audience or a community audience around what you learned from baseball. And what do you tell them when they say that's great, but you're an athlete, how do I connect you? What are the things that you've learned that are relevant for their lives and trying to make a difference in the world?
Yeah, one of the things I knew that I had a good skill set in, my wife will attest to this, and so a lot of my teammates, is I have the gift to talk and to blab, but I also love telling stories. And one thing I learned through baseball is it's such a game of failure, and the successes are great, and they're high moments. But when you're not doing well, there's not really that like moment. There's just like life stinks or life's great moment, right? In baseball. But I learned a lot in this game, and I learned a lot of things about life in this game, and how to deal with failure and how to succeed in high pressure situations and how to build good teams. And a lot of it I learned here in San Francisco watching how they built championship teams and what it takes to be impactful as a team leader, as a team player, as how to deal with certain scenarios. But I knew that I wanted to be on the public speaking circuit, and I love public speaking. But I was afraid that I would be like, well, you're only going to be able to talk to athletes. I don't want to just talk to athletes. I was a pro athlete. I think for some of the antics I did on the field, I wouldn't say athlete. I think I was just kind of classified in the group. Like a lot of my teammates called me the kicker on the team. It's situation, but for me, I wanted to be able to impact communities corporately, athletically. I wanted to interact with all facets of a community and share some of the things that I learned and how I can make impact in their lives too. And so I've really, I've just developed different scenarios when I public speak now of like, I might have baseball stories, but they apply to everybody's life, whether it be failure, whether it be how to succeed through failure, where even my whole thought process on failure is actually a should be eliminated from the dictionary. I don't think failure, I think they're teachable moments, because failure is so negative and so dead and so non-hopeful that I don't like to even call them failures. I think anytime that you don't succeed, there's a teachable moment how you can learn to become better and have a and you have a second chance. You always have a new day. If the sun comes up, you start over, right? And so I get to have those opportunities because I learned a lot of that in baseball. And I learned how to succeed in high-pressure situations and why we succeeded in those situations. And you see, I mean, the playoffs, you're down 2-0 going in Cincinnati, and you got to win 3 straight. You're down 3-1 in St. Louis. You got to win 3 straight to beat them 4-3. There's reasons why that took place, and I enjoy talking about them. I enjoy telling my story, and I enjoy the maybe I'm a competitive person, so I enjoy the maybe the journey of like someone saying, "Hey, I need you to talk to a group of investors on this topic," and I'm gonna be like, I don't even know how to invest, but I gotta try to do it, and I feel like I can do it well, and so I enjoy that, and I enjoy creating hope in people, momentum in people to become somebody great, because I came from a school of 500 people where when I signed to play professionally, they said, you know what, have fun in the minor leagues, but you're probably only gonna get to A ball, you know, and so people telling me that to my face. To wanting to kind of play the Toby Keith "How Do You Like Me Now" song when I came out and pitched, but you know, just kind of looking at those different scenarios, you know, and that's competitive for me, and I like impacting communities through my ability to tell stories and to show leadership skills, because I do think I develop them. I think as athletes we're natural leaders, but I think there's a development process there that I had to learn, and I enjoy sharing some of my areas of leadership and how I view leadership.
Okay. Well, we've got a few more minutes here. I want to make sure I'm woven a lot of the audience questions into what I've been asking you, but I want to ask you one more thing and then a couple really specific audience questions. So you've also, in both your community ambassador role for the Giants as well as just your personal relationships and an organization that you're helping, are trying to pass this advice on to other athletes so that, as you said, You know, you're not negative role models, you're positive role models. How's that going? I know your wife kind of heard your stories a million times and thinks they're kind of entertaining, but what do other athletes think when you talk to them about this?
You know, it takes a while to get into an athlete, though. Like, the problem with athletes is they're very guarded, and they're kind of somewhat prideful in the sense of like, hey, it's hard to talk to somebody because they feel like, well, I got here using my skill set, so I want to try to do that. So to get into an athlete and get them to kind of hear what you have to say, you have to really gain trust with them. And I think I've done that. I try to learn their families. I try to encourage them, serve them. And the more you serve, you know, your fellow peers, the more you're going to have a voice in their life. And the more you truly get to know them, you're going to have a voice in their life. And that's what I tried to do. And one of the things that I've said is, like, you're going to be a role model whether you want to or not. The statement from an athlete that said, "I didn't want to be a role model," too bad. Then don't do the job. Like, if you don't want to be a role model, don't put your cleats on. Don't put basketball shoes on. Don't put your football shoes on. Don't play soccer. Don't play tennis. Whatever it is, if you don't want to be a role model, then don't do the job as a pro athlete, because you're going to be one. Media forces you to be one. You're either going to be a good one or you're going to be a bad one. You're going to be a role model that makes kids become negative in who they are, or they're going to become positive in who they are. And I chose to go the positive route. And I try to explain that with the guys, like, your decisions, the way you act on the playing surface, whatever playing surface you're on, the way you handle yourself in the media, the way you handle yourself in the community. You might not be a person that's outspoken and outgoing. You don't have to do that stuff. You don't have to do it like I did it. I just think that the decisions you make and the kind of personality that you have, try to ooze goodness. And when you're around someone, let that aroma be, hey man, I'm a person that cares about other people, and I care about my community, and I'm a good father to my children, I'm a good husband to my wife. And you're gonna have bad moments in every area of that aspect, but your personality, your character, what you stand for, why you're an athlete, what you're trying to promote as an athlete is very, very, very important. A guy like Buster Posey, he's not outspoken necessarily. He's more now. you know, with his stuff with pediatric cancer and stuff like that. But he chooses to do it correctly. When he hits a homer, he runs it on the bases. He doesn't untuck his shirt. And, you know, like, obviously, if you've read the article I wrote on the things I'm not going to miss about baseball, one of them was like, you do an antic and a whole promotional deal. When you get a walk, you're shooting arrows in the sky and you're saluting and you're dancing and you're backflipping on a walk. Like, who cares? You walked. Like, it ain't that big of a deal, dude. Like, I mean, come on, man. It was, you know, I mean, you're on first base. You didn't do anything, you know? Like, you know, so, like, for me, like, all that stuff is, it doesn't do any, because now all you see in the Little League, you're seeing a guy hit a homer and wave by. I mean, I kind of chuckled when I saw it, but it was like the Little League World Series. You're seeing these athletes, and they're molding themselves on what they see. And I want to see guys act like a Buster Posey or even, you know, like, Mad Bum has his moments, but, you know, like, most of the time, you know, he competes, strikes guy, walks off, you know, he wants to win, or you know, just handle yourself in a way that promotes goodness. And as an athlete, I want you to promote the good in the world, not highlight the bad. And because the media is going to want to do it. And I want them to be bored because you're good at who you are and you're a good person and you're creating goodness in your community because you're a part of a community, whether you like it or not. And if you can see what the World Series did to this community and the way it brought San Francisco and the Bay Area together as a people was amazing for me to see. I never thought in my wildest dreams that winning a World Series would affect a community like it did. So if you have that much impact on a community, then do it for good, not for bad. And that's how I try to encourage the guys, and it seems like it's working.
That's great. So there were a couple really intriguing questions that I just have to ask you that I got from the audience. One was, what's your fondest memory of Bruce Bochy?
Oof. Fondest memory of Bruce Bochy. Oh, man. You know what? And I'll be serious. I usually make fun of his head and stuff, which is a it's not even a memory. It's just fond every time I get to look at it, you know. But I, you know, in him and I were disagreeing with each other in the 2010 playoffs. He wasn't pitching me, and I was not happy with him for it. And there was a couple moments, even he had me warmed up, and he left a guy in and gave up a homer to a lefty twice, Ankiel and
not that you remember this.
Yeah, right? not trying to remember this. Ankiel and Hinsky, both I was warming up for and gave up homers. So we were not seeing eye to eye, and he knew it. It was through some of our discussions. But you know what? He did something that was pretty awesome in Philly in that what people understand, I got when I came in that game six, when he handed me the ball, he looked at me. And what he said a little thing, but when he looked at me, it was like, hey, we're going to let bygones be bygones right here. And he basically put the ball in my hand and he says, hey, this is why I saved you. You get us out of this and we're going to go to the World Series. And I need you to think that way. And man, when he said that to me, like, it was like, all right, you know, he goes, I know you haven't pitched in a long time, but you're fresh. And this is why I need you to be fresh, because you're going to have to cover three innings in a game that I need you to figure out how to get us through. And when I came through, and I could have tanked it. I could have tanked it and given up a homer to Howard, whatever. I could have blown that deal. I didn't. But it felt so good to me to know that my leader had handed me the ball, and he said, basically, this is why I saved you, knowing like the impact that you're about to have and can have. If you just focus on why you're here and do this for me, it was great. And at the end of the game in the interview, he said, Affelt saved us. And I'm not usually a pat on the back type guy. That's not why I did my job. But it meant a lot to me to have a guy that did not pitch me when I thought it should have been pitched, hand me a ball and say, I believe in you, I trust you, and I'm trusting you with one of the biggest games in Giants baseball history. And to be able to be entrusted by a guy like that was pretty impressive, and I am very thankful that he said that to me.
That's great. So another question that was intriguing, at least to me, which is, when are you going to run for office?
Man, I'll tell you, you know, I'm trying to be kind of politically straight. I've thought about it, to be honest with you. You know, that's an interesting thing. I didn't think I'd ever even like any of that stuff. I'm like, I am not doing that. I'm not getting my hands. I've got a couple friends that are, one of my best friends is Kevin Parker. He's the state rep. He just stopped it for Washington. And just learning about how he sees politics and understanding leadership roles, man, it's very important. And one thing I've decided to do is One of the politically views for me, and I'm not getting into it, obviously, but I'm just saying I've decided to not look to Washington. Because I've said, well, if I'm going to depend on all those guys to change this nation, it ain't working for me. So I want to say this: let's not just give up and be like, well, look to them. How about we do it? It's so important that what each and every one of us individually can do for our community to bring change, not only in our city, but our state and our country. And I don't have to just look to them. I want to look to us, and I want to look to individuals, and I want to say, wait a minute. Like, they've got so much going on over there, it's confusing to 99% of the people in this country. But we have agendas that we can all focus on, and let's focus on that. And I think if we can bring hope to our communities simply because we love our neighbor, simply because we love the communities in which we live in, that's important to me. And there's so many agendas that can confuse us in D.C. that I would rather say, look, let them figure it out. I would rather just say, look, I'm not going to get caught up in that. I'm going to say, well, what can I do? What can I do to bring change, cultural change within my community or in my state or in my community? And I'm going to focus on that. And I'm not going to allow any kind of political agenda or frustrations, because it doesn't matter who you are over there. Someone's going to be mad at you. Someone's going to love you. It's like being an umpire. Well, I mean, most times everybody hates the umpire, but you know, like, I'm just saying, you know, like, it's like that, like, you're never going to please everybody. So it's like, I you know what, this is what I want to be a part of. This is what I'm going to pour into. And I'm not just going to sit back and say, why doesn't someone figure out how to do this? How about I say, why don't I figure out how to do it? Cause that's the only way change is going to come into play. So I'm not going to gripe and groan about why someone isn't doing it. If I want it done, I'm going to figure out how to get people together, and we're going to make change, and that's what I'm all about.
That's a terrific way to get to the unfortunate moment that we're about at the end of the program, and I really only have time for one more question before closing out, which is, most of us knew you when you were an athlete, and we admired you, at least in the playoffs. And but some of us are getting to know you a little bit more in your post-athletic career, and know you as a leader and a community champion. What I want to know is, are you having any fun doing this?
Yeah, you know I am, man. I'm having a blast. I enjoy. Maybe it's just part of my pride. Maybe it's just because I like being happy. But I enjoy motivating people, but I also enjoy making impact and seeing the smiles it impacts, that an impact will create on people. And I enjoy giving my views. I enjoy creating joy in a community. I enjoy being a part of baseball. I get to be a part of baseball still. Look, I retired because I was done with the on-field stuff. I mean, it's hard on us. It really is. My body was hurting pretty good. I played 20 years on that field, and if you count since I was five, I played 32 years. It's the first time in 32 years I've had a summer where I'm not playing sports, right? So my body got tired. But I did not leave the city. I said that in my speech. This is still one of the places that I will call home. I'm not leaving baseball. I just left the kind of baseball that I was playing. I play a different game. I like to analyze it. I like to be a part of it. I like to help out and create whatever baseball can create in a community I want to be a part of, just not on the field. And my knee braces were telling me that when I'm hobbling over to first. But I get to be a part of, the reason I chose to be a part of the Giants is because of they stand for everything that I stand for as a baseball player. And I want to be a part of that, and they're allowing me to be a part of it. I get to do TV stuff. I get to hang with the players still. I get to do all the fun stuff and not deal with any of the stress. The last 2 days were not my fault, and I was completely okay with that, right? So, like, I was pumped about that. So, you know, I am having a lot of fun because I don't deal with those stresses. So.
Yeah, right. Well, our thanks to Jeremy Affeldt, the former San Francisco Giants pitcher, philanthropist, author of this great book, To Stir a Movement, which I encourage everyone to buy. There's autographed copies in the back of the room today, and we'll have him back when he talks about his new book. And most importantly, Jeremy's a fantastic role model and a leader in the community, and someone that I'm delighted that we got to spend an hour with. So we thank our audiences here on the radio, television, and the internet, and thank you very much, Jeremy, for all
you've
done.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's awesome. Thank you.